Welcome to El Paso Food Voices. I'm Meredith E. Abarca. Today's episode on food choice forms part of El Paso Food Voices' special feature on culinary heritage and culinary kinship. This special feature is the result of a class-based project for a graduate seminar I thought with the title Mapping Culinary Narratives. My students and I came up with the idea of creating what we're calling an audio documentary. The goal has been to trace out the routes and routes that a food store is mapped, and then to use this to define, redefine, challenge the limits, and embrace the possibilities that kinship and heritage offer. So today, our guests are three of my students in this class, Victor, Stephanie, and Purna. So I want to welcome you to El Paso Food Voices.
Thank you, Dr. Abarca. I'm Purna Chandra Bhusal, originally from Bihadi Rural Municipality, Parwat District, western part of Nepal. And I'm currently pursuing my PhD in rhetoric and writing studies at the University of Texas at El Paso.
Hi, thank you for inviting me. My name is Victor Campos. I was born and raised in the El Paso and Ciudad Juarez region. I am a fronterizo, and right now I'm completing my MA of Literature at the University of Texas at El Paso.
Hi, thank you for having us. I'm Stephanie Aguilar, born and raised in El Paso, Texas. I'm currently pursuing my MA in Literature at UTEP.
Okay, so today we're going to talk about 3 points. And the first one we're going to be talking about has to do with something we call food choice. So to get us started, I wanted to bring up a conversation that I heard from Sheena Iyengar.
One does not put sugar in green tea. I understand, I said, that the Japanese do not put sugar in their green tea, but I'd like to put some sugar in my green tea.
So, first of all, I want to ask Bruna and Stephanie what they make of it.
I think it's simply her choice.
Yeah, I mean, if that's what she likes, then go for it. Everyone has a different palate.
Yeah, you know, the thing that really interested me about this part is that the very existence of a reason for doing something different, right? And it really reminded me about something I read from Meredith Abarca, in which she says that, you know, our food choices or whatever we eat can define who we are and what we do, but we can also rewrite them. So in other words, there's never a neutral relationship to food, because it also changes. So what do you make of this, Bruno?
Yeah, thank you, Victor. Yeah, Dr. Abarca, he's here. You have just written a recent article, and the most important line I found is food is never neutral. Food choice is not neutral. And yeah, I absolutely agree with Dr. Abarca's statement, because when I look at myself, I have so many food choices, and the most typical one is a plate of rice and a bowl of mixed vegetable, a little bit of chutney, 2 spoons of ghee, and at the end, a glass of warm milk. Okay, that's my choice. But at the same time, when I give a second thought, my food choice then transports back to me, to my childhood, to my village, and a whole kitchen drama appears in my mind. And in the drama, my mother is the director, the cook, and the parents and my 3 siblings and myself, we were the actors, the eating actors. And the interesting thing is we talked a lot while eating. Therefore, it is also related to what Dr. Abarca calls that charlas culinarias, the culinary chats. Okay. And when I just give a second thought or third reflection, then I reach the kitchen of my neighbors, my friends, is my villagers, my relatives, but I could smell and I could taste the same sort of aroma, the taste, the smell everywhere. The whole village used to produce the same aroma. Therefore, I am rather undecided whether my food choice is typically my food choice, or I have been made to make those choices. Therefore, I believe food choice is never neutral.
So in other words, do you make your food choices? Do we make your food choices? Or the choices of things that we eat make us who we are? Sort of.
Yeah, I am somewhere in between. For example, right. I obviously start talking with my food choices. But when I do a sort of critical reflection, then there are so many influencing factors behind my food choices and my family, my community is, and my palate memory, my emotion is, all these things play an active role behind the scene.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful example. So, you know, I'm wondering if you, Stephanie, have something similar to Purna's experience. Like, have you thought of your food choice in this way, or do you agree with the argument that it changes?
Yeah, it definitely changes. Just wanted to say that I've definitely rewritten my culinary identity. I relate a lot to Merida de la Parca's interview with Roman Wilcox. In that interview, Roman Wilcox talks about how when he was younger, there was a harder time when him and his family didn't really have time to prioritize health. And like, as he got older, he started to prioritize health more. And like, I relate a lot to what he said about how passionate he was about growing clean foods, eating clean foods, growing foods himself and for his students. And I relate a lot to Roman Wilcox's story because of that.
I don't have a problem with people eating meat. I'm not a meat shamer. I'm not even a vegan, you know? But I do know what goes into that factory farming. I do know, you know, the intensity of just the flat out cruelty. The insincere, just the irresponsibility, and that we just turn our head and accept it because it's there.
Let me just say something about Roman Wilcox and put a little bit of that in context. First of all, because if he listens to this, we need to like clarify with the audience that he has become a vegan. So this idea that food is never neutral is reflected here. He's been a vegan, I think, for 4 years now, or longer. But what he was talking about there is that when he's a chef here in El Paso, when he was teaching in a culinary school program in a high school, and he was working with young kids, he was teaching Food Inc. And through that documentary, he learned the cruelty that the food industry imposes on animals. And that's really what he's talking about. So when he says that cruelty, he's talking about that part of the food system. But I also wanted to clear out, in case Roman hears this, that we are acknowledging that he has become a vegan.
That's amazing. That's very admirable, because I personally can never be a vegan. I'm identify as a pescatarian since I was 12. Yeah, but I identify with his story a lot, for sure. I cut out meat at 12, and like, I remember seeing those slaughterhouse videos when I was younger, and it was just they were really awful. So it wasn't hard for me to cut out red meat. I cut out red meat, chicken, pork. I really only eat fish, a little bit of fish. I really love salmon, but I'm not into shellfish.
So going on from that idea, Stephanie, it sounds like you believe in individual food choices, but is that the case, or is it similar to Purna, where that choice is informed by something else?
Definitely. Choice is definitely important when it comes to your culinary identity, your culinary kinship. I think, like I said, I've rewritten my own culinary kinships. At a very young age, I rewrote it. And I'm very proud of that choice. You know, I try to be as healthy as I can most of the time. Since we're talking about choice, sometimes I don't always make the best eating choices. You know, choice is very important when it comes to health. You know, sometimes I don't make the best eating choices. I mean, who can stay away from pizza, right? you know, dessert is really amazing. See, that's why I can never be a vegan, because of dessert, you know, and cheese pizza and all that. Like, being a vegan would be very hard. So I admire Roman Wilcox for that, for sure.
Cool. Yeah, thank you, Stephanie, for sharing your just stories of your food choices. And I would like to really hear from Victor. Victor, in your case, what's food choice, or how food choice define yourself and your identity?
Well, whenever I think of food, it automatically reminds me of survival. When I was younger, you know, I grew up in Ciudad Juarez, which is right across the border of El Paso. So during 2008 and 2012, there was a cartel wars. And coincidentally, me and my family were very poor. We found ourselves on a difficult financial situation. So while I didn't really like, there wasn't a day where I didn't have food, right? But my choices were limited. Right. Sometimes my dad would bring food from his job at Golden Corral. Sometimes my mom would have to cook with whatever she had, or sometimes our family members would send us food. The point is that sometimes I would ask for stuff and my parents would feel bad because they couldn't provide it for me. Right. But that wasn't always the case. There were times in which I could choose. And for me, those times became extremely valuable, so food became sort of sacred, right? Now that I have more of a choice on, like, what I can buy and eat or make for myself, I'm not picky. I try to be as less picky as possible, because what was once something that defined my survival is now a chance for me to explore.
Thank you, Victor and Stephanie, for sharing your stories of food choices. So, my friends, can we just come to the generalization that people have individual food choices, but those food choices have been influenced and informed by multiple factors?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think we do make the choice, but in the end, for us to come to that conclusion, a lot of stuff has to happen.
Okay, thank you. Then we talked a lot about our food choices and how our food choices have been influenced by different factors. I think it's the time to reflect on how our food choices helps us to create networks of relationships, how our food choice plays an influencing role in our life. So before conversation, let's listen to a dialogue from the movie East Side Sushi.
I have a little surprise.
Oh, what you got there, Chamarcan?
I'm starving.
I think you're gonna like this, but first you have to be open to something different.
I see rice. What is it?
That's what they call sushi, mi amor.
Yes, it's muy delicioso. This is the food at mommy's restaurant. It's Japanese.
Yes, Victor, does this particular moment say something about our food choices and the relationships created by those food choices?
Yeah, I mean, before jumping into, you know, answering your question, I think some of the context for this scene, you know, in Isai Sushi, this woman named Juana, she gets a new job at a sushi restaurant. And her family is a little bit not willing to taste something different, right? So whenever she brings something other than Mexican cuisine, there's, of course, a little bit of a resistance there. But I think what this scene reveals to us, or at least to me, it sounds a little bit like kinship.
Culinary kinship. My friends, I think this is a big word. I heard of only kinship as a type of something like the blood relationship that binds people together. But do you mean culinary kinship means the building the network of relationships or the binding principle among the people created by means of food?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's sort of like the idea.
Okay, then we'd like to hear something from Stephanie regarding your culinary kinship.
Yeah, you know, I remember that scene from Misa at Sushi. I always get very invested when I watch movies. I remember that scene. Juana was very nervous to feed her little family sushi for the first time because the sushi is just so foreign to them. And I can relate to that definitely because I didn't try sushi until I was like 27. A friend of mine had to beg me to try sushi for the first time. Good, fresh sushi. And like Juana did, like in the movie, when Juana tries good, fresh sushi for the first time, she really enjoys it. And I had that same experience. I remember that. That scene was really important. I think that scene was really important to the movie because she's really nervous at first. She probably knew her father was going to reject it right away because he's an old Mexican man. He's like a mule, you know, he's stubborn like me. I can relate to that too. I'm pretty stubborn too, which is why I didn't try sushi until I was like 27. Yeah, and what I remember from that scene especially was her daughter. She was open right away, and that's what I love about kids. I work with kids. I've been working with kids for like 4 years. That's what I love about kids is that they have this openness to them to try new things.
Yeah, I just want to add something about this film that we watch in class. We are, as a matter of fact, open the class, mapping culinary narratives with that film, and I think it says a couple of things about kinship. That I think we can add to its definition, right? There's a different format of relationships that she's Juana forming with her father and her daughter. And when you bring in Stephanie about how the younger palate, in this case, the younger kid, seems a little more open to it than the father who's used to his ways, right? But thinking about the film in its totality, there's also another kind of kinship to negotiate here, to think about. This is Juana, a Mexican woman who is a Mexican cook. I mean, she's a chef. She knows how to cook a lot of Mexican food. Enters into a Japanese restaurant, a sushi bar. And early on in the film, if you remember, she's not allowed to cook in the bar because she's a woman, because her hands are warm, her hands cannot handle sushi, da-da-da-da. But as the movie progresses, we see she does become the sushi chef, right? The owner of the restaurant is allowing her to serve him. There's another scene in the film when we see the chef, and we see a scene where he goes and has an evening out with Juana, and they're eating all this Mexican food. So my point is that here is a form on which culinary kinship is beyond this idea of blood relationships. It's a relationship, it's a bonding, it's a caring that is formed because of the food that we are sharing together, because of the openings that we have for other people's culinary culture. And I think this film shows that quite well.
Thank you, Dr. Abarca.
Yeah, I mean, adding on to this point, I think I can relate with my experience. I'm a strong believer that, you know, people are in constant change. And particularly with people like me who are fronterizos. In other words, people that live interchangeably between two places that are separated by a national border. Our identities are in constant flux. And another term that I like is transfronterizo, which refers to this constant transformation of, you know, the different crossings that we experience, right? So just like the fronterizo experience, I think our relationship to food is also in constant transformation. Yeah, and you know, all it takes is to be open to something different. But I don't know if any of my peers have a similar story.
Yeah, Victor, thank you for the floor. Yeah, I have so many stories. I believe I have at least two homes. One is physical home, which is back in Nepal, and next one is the culinary home. The physical home is made up of those building blocks, bricks, cement, yes, and concrete. But the culinary home is always traveling with me. Do you know why? It is because it is made up of my memory, my sensorial memory, my palate, my sense of choice, my sense of taste, and my just all those childhood memories living in a village. It's always traveling. Therefore, when I see the food of my choice, I feel complete in myself. And I have one interesting story. One of my friends from Norway told me that when Purna is having the food of his choice, I have to call him at least twice to draw his attention. Do you know why? It is because I am living in my culinary home. Yes. And therefore, when just I start eating the food of my choice, you know, then I feel satiated. I feel complete. I feel living just I re-enliven my memory. And while re-enlivening my memory, then a sense of identity has been created. And this very identity is my culinary identity. Therefore, my culinary identity lives in my culinary home. My culinary home lives in me.
Wow, that's a really powerful and interesting connection you make, particularly with your culinary home that is always within you, right? But Stephanie, do you have a response to this or something that you would like to add?
You know, Dr. Varka can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but our culinary kinship is always changing. Our culinary identity is always changing. You know, sometimes it changes whether we're ready for it or not. You know, when I cut out red meat when I was 12 years old, I didn't imagine that it would be a part of my culinary identity. I was 12 years old. I didn't think that far. I didn't think that deeply. I didn't know that it would ultimately become my culinary identity. It would become, I had no idea that I was rewriting my culinary kinship. So that was really cool.
You know, one way that I would see that your culinary kinship has expanded or has changed, if that's the right word, Stephanie, is that by defining yourself as a
pescatarian,
thank you so much. You're forming connections, deep connections, for social reasons, for ethical reasons, for environmental reasons, with other people who have made the same choice, regardless of whether those people are Mexican, regardless of whether those people are from El Paso, regardless of all that other aspects that form what we normally think of kinship, right? Interesting, because one question that I would have is, being Mexican, being from El Paso, eating tamales that are coming out with are filled with pork, has your family kinship been affected by your choices of food? Has there been any tension in your family, or have they all been extremely supportive about these choices? Or how do you negotiate the family space if you're the only one who only eats fish? Well, but let me rephrase that. Not the only one that eats fish, because I'm sure the members of your family eat fish, but the only one who does not eat red meat.
You know, a lot of people in my family don't eat fish because that's very foreign. Growing up, it was Mexican food at all the parties, the quinceañeras, the birthday parties, all of the family gatherings. It was always the same food, and I think that's why I was so reluctant to try sushi for the first time. I think that's why it took me so long to try sushi, because it was just so foreign to me, and I was used to the same foods all my life.
What are some of those foods? You say the same foods, what do you mean?
Just the same generic Mexican foods, like enchiladas, quesadillas, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Arroz.
I guess if we're from El Paso, would we include brisket, maybe?
Oh, you know? Yeah. I remember eating brisket as a child.
Okay, that explains something. The fact that you have not eaten red meat, I should not be asking you for all these red meat dishes, right?
As a very young child, I remember eating brisket. Mm. It was awful. Mm. So we are going to talk about embodying our culinary choices, our culinary identities. I'm sure we all have some very interesting stories to tell. Let's talk about our embodiment of our culinary kinship, our culinary identity.
And I understand we have we're going to hear from somebody to make us think about this.
Yes, Olivio Okehe.
So let's listen from Olivio Okehe and see what he says about embodiment and food.
There's definitely something about food. It's beyond biological sustenance. It's love, it's home, it's memories, it's celebration, it's beauty, it's hope. is health and so much more.
Great words of wisdom from her. From our story so far, I think it's fair to say that food is indeed beyond our biological sustenance.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the point of creating a culinary kinship, to see beyond borders, to see beyond, biological sustenance. It's about creating relationships and interconnections through something that is so dear and close to us, and something that we do in a community, which is always, eating together.
Yes, I think that this is the point of creating a culinary kinship through our choice, is to see beyond how food keeps us alive and forms part of our identity. I think culinary kinship is the matter of embodiment. What do you think, Victor?
Yeah, I mean, when I think of embodiment, I think of my own experience. I'll make this really short, but when I was 12 years old, I came to El Paso to finally start my education here in the United States.
So in that August of 2012, the world expanded for me, realizing that just across a single river, there was a whole familiar yet alien culture to me, was really interesting because, I struggled for many years, figuring out where I belonged. Is it this side of the river or this other side? But through many years, I understood that I'm much more than that. And whenever I came here to UTEP, I met people from all over the world, Bhutan, Colombia, Southern Mexico, you name it, right? And they are like me. We are people that we transform and we adapt depending on where we are and who we meet. So, like my dad, who is a cook, he draws sazon from multiple types of culinary, different types of food, Mexican, American, Italian, Chinese. So in my home, I never really got the traditional Mexican sazon. So like my dad, I also draw from the people I meet and how he does it, and I incorporate it into my own type of sazon, I guess.
How do you embody culinary kinship, Runa?
Yeah, I have so many stories regarding culinary kinship because I have made so many physical and emotional transitions in my life. For example, I lived in my village till I was 19. After school education, I moved to city, and in the city, I did arrive of food hunting, and I visited different restaurants and hotels to find the food of my choice. And luckily, I found one, and I was the regular visitor of that restaurant. And I not only created a relationship with food, but also built a network with the people who had similar food choices. And after 3 years, I moved to capital city Kathmandu for my graduate study. And even in the capital city, I had to do a lot of food hunting because this my culinary kinship, my embodied, this memory, nostalgia was traveling with me. And luckily, the story repeated, I found some of the restaurants where I could find my food. And I married, and luckily, my wife and me, we had the similar food choice. Therefore, we didn't have only the relationship between husband and wife. We built also something like the culinary kinship while cooking and eating together. Then later I moved to Norway. And when I was in Norway, I worked in an Indian restaurant, not for money, but for the food they served. Yes, I used to work every Sunday at night. Yes, I used to stay late night just waiting for the food of my choice. Yes. And even I created my relationship with food and people even in Norway. And last year I came to United States for my PhD, and I didn't find many restaurants and hotels in El Paso where I could find the food of my choice. Therefore, I started cooking. Yes, and these days I can cook my food, the food of my choice. But whenever I start eating my food, then I recall the Charla's culinary, yes, with my mother. And it's a type of this, let's say, the food nostalgia. And I was planning to visit my mom, but last summer in July, I lost my mom. Therefore, whenever I cook and whenever I eat, just I revive the memory of living with my parents and my siblings. It revives the memory. For example, in El Paso Food Voices, Higo Elora cooks to keep his mom alive. But I cook and eat to keep my memory alive. That's my story.
Wow, I think that's a really powerful account, and it really does show us how we embody kinship in different ways. And I'm just wondering, Stephanie, how do you think you embody your own kinship?
Well, first off, I would like to point out something very important about my story. I think it's really important to say about my story that, like, I had the luxury to choose. I was fortunate enough to never experience food scarcity in my life. My parents were always pretty well off, and you know, I had that luxury to choose to erase red meat from my plate. And my, you know, I was underage. I was a 12-year-old girl. My parents didn't have to comply with my choice. They could have told me, no, you're not making this choice, but they complied with my choice. I was 12 years old, I didn't have a job, and my mom would go out of her way to, you know, buy me like these plant-based brands at the grocery stores, and like I'm really grateful for that. And I think it's really important to eat healthy. It taught me to eat in a healthier way. And I was listening to a TED talk by this man named Mark Bittman the other day, just to do more research.
The evidence is very clear that plants promote health. This evidence is overwhelming at this point. You eat more plants, you eat less other stuff, you live longer. Not bad.
So I guess we should start eating more vegetables?
Yeah, absolutely. Longer. You know, I don't even think that man is, he's probably not even a vegan, but he just wanted to put an emphasis on how important it is to eat, to include more plants into your diet, you know.
I want to go back to something that you just said about your parents and you being 12 years old and deciding to, I love the way you said it, erase red meat from your plate. That's a wonderful phrase. Mm-hmm. But it actually points to another way of thinking about kinship. Because yes, we're speaking about your parents, and obviously they're your blood-related kinship. But the fact that they honor and respected a 12-year-old girl's choice, to me, reinforces that notion of a culinary kinship. It's because culinary kinship is also about the idea, notion of respecting somebody else's choice. So you just formulated another way of thinking a little more deeply about what culinary kinship is or can be.
I don't know if respected is the right word. They complied with my choice, but they thought I was very strange, for sure. So did everyone else. My tias, my cousins, they thought I was very strange, but after the first 10 years, they got used to it.
Great.
So I think from these stories, I think we can sort of come to a conclusion of saying that food choice develops kinship, and therefore our personal stories are interconnected with this concept, but also with people in general.
Yes, Victor and Stephanie. Yeah, I believe this people have food choices, and based on those food choices, they build culinary kinship in their life. And when just people start reflecting on their culinary kinship, it becomes a part and parcel of their identity formation. In this sense, I think we need to think of food as an anchor to define ourselves, who we are, where we are from, or where we belong to. Therefore, we think a sort of what Dr. Awalka calls food consciousness.
Yes, choice. Choice is very important. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, we have connection through food. Our food choices makes us who we are. My food choices make me who I am, absolutely.
And with that, I would like to thank you for bringing your thoughts that you've been exploring about food choice and how this connected to culinary heritage and culinary kinship. So, Perna, Victor, Stephanie, thank you for this discussion. And I would like to leave us by asking our audience to think about what their food choices are, to think about how, what aspects of heritage are embedded in those choices, but also to be open to the possibilities of what new kinds of kinships or culinary kinships, making slightly different choices about our foods, can create. So with that, thank you. Thank you to the three of you, and thank you to the audience for listening. Stay tuned for more episodes on culinary heritage and culinary kinship.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
El Paso Food Voices was created by Meredith E. Abarca, Professor of Food Studies and Literature at the University of Texas at El Paso. Produced by Adrian Mesa from UTEP's Creative Studios. To learn more about how food practices, memories, and stories shape a city's history, culture, and its character, please visit us at El Paso Food Voices. Thank you.